Good morning. I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich.
And I'm Chris Vanderpoel.
It's Wednesday, November 21st. From HBR2, it's The Conversation. So a Buddhist and a Hindu walk into Congress.
Another call to shop. It's Cottage Industry Weekend. That's craft fair to me and you.
Credit where credit is due, but not for solar.
Time for church. Get the snake.
Plus, today's reality check, the worldview from Deutsche Welle, and Turkey not so confidential in the backyard. Now, the NPR News.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Lakshmi Singh. Egypt is announcing a ceasefire between Israel and Gaza's Hamas due to take effect at 2 p.m. Eastern. Egyptian Foreign Minister Mohammed Kamel Amer appeared before reporters with U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton, who spoke moments ago at a news conference in Cairo.
This is a critical moment for the region. Egypt's new government is assuming the responsibility and leadership that has long made this country a cornerstone of regional stability and peace.
The announcement came just hours after a bus was attacked in Tel Aviv, injuring at least 24 people. There's no word yet that the Israeli airstrikes and Hamas rocket fire have stopped. The last week of violence has claimed at least 140 lives in Gaza and 5 in Israel. After a marathon meeting on emergency funding for Greece, the Greek government is fuming that it still has to wait for that bailout. EU leaders say they'll resume discussions at a summit tomorrow. Joanna Kakissis reports from Athens that the stalemate caused Greek bank shares to fall sharply in early trading.
Much of the nearly $40 billion in loans will go to recapitalize banks, which have been starved of funds since a bond swap earlier this year. Greek leaders say their country has done everything its lenders, which include the European Union and the International Monetary Fund, have demanded, including pushing through unpopular austerity measures. Prime Minister Andonis Samaras canceled an investment trip to Qatar to meet today with Jean-Claude Juncker, who leads the Eurozone finance ministers. Samaras says the aid delay is threatening the stability of the euro. EU leaders will discuss Greece again at a summit on Thursday. For NPR News, I'm Joanna Kakissis in Athens.
Congolese rebels who've captured the strategic eastern border city of Goma are vowing to take over all of Democratic Republic of Congo, including the faraway capital, Kinshasa. NPR's Afabia Quist-Arkton reports the rebels have already addressed thousands of local residents.
M23 rebel colonel Vianney Kazarama threatened to seize all of Congo to loud cheers from civilians who crowded into the stadium in Goma, the city the rebels captured on Tuesday. The colonel claims they already control the town of Sake en route to the key city of Bukavu, the capital of the twin province of South Kivu. Kazarama pledges the rebels will push on to Congo's capital, Kinshasa, more than 1,000 miles away. Meanwhile, Congolese President Joseph Kabila and Rwanda's leader Paul Kagame have been holding talks in neighboring Uganda. Both Rwanda and Uganda deny accusations they're backing Congo's rebels. Ofebia Quistarkton, NPR News, Accra.
Dow is up 47. This is NPR. Former boxing champion Hector Macho Camacho is, as one doctor put it, in the most important fight of his life. Camacho is reported to be on life support in a San Juan, Puerto Rico hospital with gunshot wounds to his face and neck. Police say the car Camacho was driving in was attacked last night in his hometown of Bayamon. Another man who was driving that vehicle reportedly died in the attack. The Archbishop of Canterbury is sharply criticizing a vote by the Church of England's governing body which rejects the ordination of female bishops. Larry Miller reports the Archbishop says the Church, quote, has some explaining to do.
After the vote by the Church of England's General Synod, many female clergy were in tears. Despite every male bishop voting in favor of ordaining women bishops, the measure fell 6 votes short of the necessary 2/3 majority of lay members. Opponents argued the move is contrary to the Bible's example of male leadership. Reflecting on the vote, Archbishop of Canterbury Rowan Williams says the Church has lost credibility.
A great deal of this discussion is not intelligible to our wider society.
Officials say it could be another 5 years before the issue comes to a vote again. For NPR News, I'm Larry Miller in London.
A measure of what U.S. economic activity might be like in 3 to 6 months is still pointing up. The Conference Board says its index of leading indicators rose 0.2% in October, following a 0.5% gain the month before. The latest increase is attributed in part to lower interest rates, more demand for durable goods, and fewer people filing new unemployment claims. I'm Lakshmi Singh, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, dedicated to the idea that all people deserve the chance to live healthy, productive lives at GatesFoundation.org.
This is The Conversation on HPR2. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. Shop local, buy local, generate a local economy. We frequently hear those messages and sometimes respond with our hearts before our heads can do a little due diligence. That can be dicey, according to Jeff Davis, known to some as the Solar Guy. He's critical of his industry and the renewable energy tax credits, and more importantly, the consumer monthly payments going to photovoltaic lease companies owned by investors outside the state. So what's a caring customer to do? Jeff Davis, welcome.
Aloha, Beth Ann. Thanks for having me in.
You know, this is a tough one for people to hear, because for a long time now we've heard that buying a solar system is a good idea, and there are tax credits for that. There's a whole issue that goes to buying a solar system, but the issue of leasing, which made it more affordable for people, has some other ramifications that not many people really stop to think about. And that's essentially your point, that all of the lease issues surrounding how you get your system really affect us in ways that we haven't even stopped to think about.
Well, you know, I think it caught us all by surprise in the industry and here in the general public in Hawaii, the idea of buying a solar, like you mentioned, something that made a lot of sense in the sense it was initially the tax credits put into place to make buying a solar affordable, very simple. When you have solar, whether it be hot water or photovoltaic to run your meter backwards, you do not buy oil by the barrels and barrels and barrels, by the billions and billions per year, that this money is obviously a drain to our tax basis, money that would otherwise run through the coffers, promote education for our children, if you will, fill the pothole. This money's not going to be available because, again, just like buying a barrel of oil, it's leaving the state, and now we've replaced it with what's known as the solar lease or power purchase agreement. It just really caught us all by surprise, I think.
Let's talk about it from a consumer perspective. Someone who has heard that maybe a lease is the way to go, because in this way they're not having to put up any money up front, right, which for a lot of people sounds awfully attractive. So what's wrong with this proposition?
Well, first of all, in order to people, it's pretty much a perfect story, Beth Ann. People have finally realized that photovoltaic is not their enemy. They did hear it cost a lot of money. It was new technology initially, and they shied away from it. As they saw it going up on roof after roof and building after building, they came to understand that this is a good thing, but they don't know how to purchase one, so it's uneducated. A knock comes on the door and says, look, you're spending $250 a month for your electricity. Let's make it $225. Let's make it $200. And you won't have to pay for anything up front. And it just sounds so quote-unquote, too good to be true. Whereas if they'd done a little due diligence and found out, first of all, how to purchase it themselves, whether they financed it, home equity loans, personal loan, tax credits to offset it, return on investment of as little as 3 years now. And I'm talking this year. It's going to change on January 1st, unfortunately. With a little bit of work involved, they could have found out how to own this. And in that regard, the $250 in monthly electric bill would stay here, go to the grocery store, run through the registers, and help support our state economy. Instead, it's you don't own it. There's a, I would say, disingenuous idea that you don't have to maintain it. These devices don't have any maintenance. They sit there and electricity moves through the grid. And for 20 years, you would be paying $200 a month or $225 a month instead of $250. effectively putting anywhere from $25 to $50 a month into the economy instead of the $250 that this tax credit was designed for you to buy it and own it. So what we've done is a barrel of oil plus a tax credit attached to it, leaving the state every month for energy.
Okay, but for simplicity's sake, and when people are hearing that the money is leaving the state, that's because, as you say, that a company that is not owned or does not have Hawaii ownership but is doing business here sells you the leasing equipment for it, and then off they go. You're still paying for 20 years down the line to this company that's not a local Hawaii company.
Correct. The money's still leaving the state. It's like a barrel of oil. As my op-ed stated, it's worse than a barrel of oil because there's the icing on the cake that says, here, take our money, take it out of the state for 20 years. I still don't own the system. I'll have to buy it at some point in the future for an unknown amount of money. That money will again leave the state. But in the meantime, take our state tax credit with you, money that came out of everybody's working pocket, and go ahead and take that out of state with you and spend it somewhere else in some other economy and support another state's economy.
When you say take that, you're talking back to the companies. The companies are being allowed to do that.
Yeah, the companies are 99% of what's happening in leasing. There is a drop in a bucket of local leasing. That would be my issue. I'm not anti-lease per se. I would say that there's a very rare number of homeowners that could use a lease. We have tax credits for retired people, refundable. So everybody's generically got some amount of tax liability, even the retired folks. However, not knowing about it, not being educated about it, the lease sounds good. You don't have to have upfront money. You're already spending $250 a month. Why not reduce it to $200 and lock yourself in for 20 years to mitigate oil costs going up or right. You know, rate increases? Unfortunately, that tax credit was there to promote the purchase of solar, so that money stayed in the state. The money is now leaving the state again.
Now, when we hit the beginning of the year and things will change, the projected increase from what started as being a $35 million incentive package now is blooming to somewhere around $174 million, at least for this past year, for 2012. There are some national experts saying that we should be getting rid of this whole tax credit issue in the first place, that it's not going to be healthy. How is that going to sync now with the idea that, as you say, leases aren't such a hot idea either? Doesn't that sort of shut consumers out in the cold a little bit?
I think it's going to help promote the idea of the lease being more popular. Okay, we reduce our state tax credits to make the purchase return on the investment less attractive. People are going to be more inclined to say, well, what the heck? I'll just let these guys put it on my roof. I don't have to have any upfront money, and I'll send my money overseas. So we've completely negated the gist of what a tax credit was supposed to accomplish, keeping money in our state of Hawaii.
Okay, well, the solar lobby has been fighting to keep the tax credits. You seem to be a little bit at odds both with other solar providers, and are you really now not, you know, being looked at in well, how to put this way, are you a pariah?
It could, in some sense, for instance, if you're a solar city, a Vivint,
Radius. I can't imagine that they like hearing what you're saying.
No, I can't imagine that either. But and I don't like it either. I would like to see everybody kumbaya and let's use this tax credit designed to what it was purposed to do. Let's keep money in the state of Hawaii. Where is our legislative leadership? Right now, they're in there reducing tax credits, and they've given us this ambiguous, well, we don't know what it's going to happen. This is a great experiment on a very big industry, what's about to happen come January, when they've reduced this credit for both commercial and residential, and they don't know how long their directive will last. It's a great limbo that they've thrown this huge juggernaut of the solar industry into beginning on January 1st. If they reduce the tax credits, I would assume on the state side, that would encourage more people to look at a lease and thereby completely shoot ourselves in the foot for everything a solar tax credit was designed to do is now going to help push money out of our state of Hawaii. It's a complete circle we've gone in.
Jeff, thanks for coming in. We're going to continue to be having this conversation. And on Monday, we're going to be speaking with the Hawaii Solar Energy Association, get their take on it too. But thanks for being here.
Aloha. Do your best. I appreciate it.
Jeff Davis is a partner with Solar Services Hawaii and is known as the solar guy. Though now, to some of the PV lease companies he's criticized, he may also be the unpopular guy.
Support for The Conversation comes from Toastmen, Inc. Bank of Hawaii presents the first annual Jake Shimabukuro and Friends concert at Hawaii Theater, a night of intimate music and storytelling this Saturday. Tickets at hawaiitheater.com and the theater box office.
Alan West's concession completes the electoral scorecard. Congress celebrates Turkey Day, a drumstick away from the fiscal cliff, and Ron Paul embraces what he calls the deeply American principle of secession. I'm Neil Conan, political junkie Ken Rudin, plus an exit interview with outgoing Ohio Democrat Dennis Kucinich. Next Talk of the Nation from NPR News.
This morning from 9 to 11, right after The Conversation. Support for The Conversation comes from Bush Consulting, providing IT support, customized network services, and backup recovery for Hawaii's businesses since 1990. Learn more about outsourced IT at buschconsulting.com.
This is The Conversation on member-supported HPR2. Later in the show, itty-bitty business sales, big holiday impact.
Ben Franklin wanted it for the national bird. Most Americans this week just want it for their dinner table. Historically, the wild turkey ranged from the northeastern U.S. to Arizona and down into Mexico. And for quite a while, turkeys have been in Hawaii, too. On the Big Island, you can see a couple of food choices on the range. Wild turkeys often trot along with the cattle. If you're a hunter, perhaps you've gone to Parker Ranch for one of their turkey shoots. More likely, you've gotten your shipped-in bird from your favorite grocery store. But back to the quiz. The largest population of turkeys is on Hawaii Island, although once they were found on all islands, including Niihau, Molokai, and Lanai. And that brings us to the question, when and how did all these turkeys get here? We'll have the answer in the next half hour.
Aloha, good morning. I'm Joshua Cooper from the Hawaii Institute for Human Rights. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR, Hawaii Public Radio. Join the conversation on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
Many people are going into the holiday giving season with a determination to buy local, and it's a really good idea. At a craft fair, you're likely to find one-of-a-kind items that have been made with loving care, and you'll be supporting a local cottage industry, people who have followed their passion to create something special. Crafters and artists are a thriving and well-organized community in Hawaii, and their biggest annual event is coming up this Saturday in Honolulu. Watercolorist Patrice Federspiel is one of 50 whose work will be on display, and she joins us this morning. Good morning, Patrice.
Good morning, Chris.
Does that describe you accurately as somebody who followed her passion to create a life and a career?
Completely, completely. I changed my life about 12 years ago when I moved here to paint.
So I was a lucky guess on my part.
Yes. When you're an artist, I think the best thing you can do is follow your passion and just take it wherever it leads you.
Well, this is a thing that more people want to do than end up doing. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering how we can encourage people who'd like to take that leap. And perhaps your example can be an encouragement to that. But how did it work out for you, making that transition?
Well, it was a bigger transition than I could have ever guessed because I really had no idea what I was getting into. But I was in the business field before I moved here. Mm-hmm. And so I had a good background. I had some graphic arts background. So I had an idea of how to get myself out there. And it was really learning my art, my craft, that was the next step. So I had a good business background. When you're in the arts on your own, you kind of have to be the marketer, the promoter, the bookkeeper, the creator. So it does mean you have to be able to multitask, at least in a stream, if not all at once.
And those aren't qualities for which many artists are well known, right?
Right. We're thought of a lot of the times, we're thought of as kind of flaky, right-brained,
dreamers.
Crazy people.
Yeah.
Which...
crazy people, that works, yeah.
And sometimes we have to be that too, because we have to be creative and you have to be able to dip into that deep well inside you to bring forth something new and different. And we do that not only for people who will hopefully buy our arts and crafts, but also for ourselves, because otherwise we'll get bored.
Well, in making art, no matter what the art, you kind of look inside yourself and find something to turn loose, right?
Right, right.
You need a sort of a, what should I call it, an untamed element inside
mm-hmm,
yourself.
A little bit of a muse.
There you go.
Mm-hmm.
But you're lucky to have, and I assume the business background helped quite a bit. In
tremendously.
Getting your career off the ground.
Mm-hmm. It did.
How can, you know, do you meet artists among your peers who sort of fall more into the dreamer category a little bit?
Well, you know, there's all kinds of people. Art is a service, really, that you do for yourself.
Mm-hmm.
Because when you're creating, you're bringing more of yourself out. You're doing a service to the world. You're bringing more of yourself out into the world to be present
mm-hmm.
and to be happier, because it really does make us happier. I know there are art therapists who will help you, you know, in terms of finding what's going on inside of yourself. It can help you with expression, with self-expression. There are places you can go. I actually have taken courses or been part of a group called artistcareertraining.com,
mm-hmm.
And I learned a lot about how to keep myself focused and focused on what I need to get done to move forward.
Well, you know, in I don't want to call them simpler cultures, but in sort of tribal
mm-hmm.
cultures,
mm-hmm.
everybody's an artist.
True.
And in hyper-civilized societies, there's this feeling that the artists are this elect.
Right.
That are
right.
only a few people who are artists and the rest of us should just sort of stay out of the way. And that's always bothered me. I always felt like, you know, everybody should make art in some way. It didn't even have to be good, right?
Because you're absolutely right. It's all about being creative. We are all creative beings. So whether we express ourselves with numbers or with paint or with music, that's what counts, to just get it out.
It's that thing about kind of letting something loose inside you, isn't
mm-hmm,
it?
Mm-hmm. Being more alive.
Well, and the result is quite a different variety of items that you see. And do you do the kind of craft fair circuit throughout the year? Go to public events where people are putting up booths and
I do. I do a select few. I don't. There are some you could go to every month of the year, but I do kind of pick and choose. And
mm-hmm.
one of the reasons I like the one this weekend so much is because it's one of the longest running craft fairs on the island. It has a lot of native crafters who participate, and people are coming in from the Big Island. They're coming in from Maui to show their wares, what they do, to share that with the public. I'll be there. Whenever I'm at a fair, I'm painting in public because I want people to see that, yes, it is a bit of magic to watch somebody create something, but we all have that magic inside of ourselves.
How do you, when, do people say that to you when they come to you, to your booth, and do they say, gee, I wish I could do that?
Oh, all the time.
Really?
All the time. And they always say, well, I can't even draw a straight line. And I always say, well, God made rulers for straight lines. We don't need anybody to make straight lines.
Well, you can almost, I mean, if you wanted to just make art now in a computer program, you could do that too.
And people do.
And that'll do the straight lines for you.
Exactly.
So it's sort of, it's almost, there's no excuse anymore, is there?
Right. Good, well put.
Well, I just hope there are ways to encourage others to do that. Maybe seeing the result of what other people have done. I mean,
mm-hmm.
when people say to you, how did you get into that kind of life? Do you feel a certain amount of envy on the part of those asking the question? I wish I could.
Oh, all the time. And the only thing I want people to understand is that, yes, I absolutely love what I do, and yes, it is a lot of work. So it's not just one or the other.
Well, that's the other thing about becoming an artist with all the wildness and freedom. If you don't work extremely hard on your craft,
mm-hmm.
it's not going to do you much good.
Exactly.
Is it? Well, thanks very much for being with us.
Thank you very much.
There's quite an event coming up this weekend. You'll be one of at least 50 artists,
mm-hmm.
right, taking
That's right.
part in that. So, and that'll just cover all kinds of different items for for possible Christmas holiday giving.
We'll be there from 9 to 3.
Terrific, Patrice. Thanks. Patrice Federspiel is a watercolor artist whose work, along with that of dozens of others, will be shown at Hawaii's oldest annual craft fair. It's hosted by Hawaiian Mission Houses and Kwaihau Church, and it's this Saturday, November 24th. You can find out more from our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for today's programming comes from Diamond Head Theater. On stage next is the musical Annie, opening Friday, December 7th. Tickets and information on the web at diamondheadtheater.com.
The Rolling Stones are celebrating 50 years at the top of rock and roll this year. Why? Here's Keith Richards.
Because we're damn good. You know, and we genuinely love what we do.
Hear more candor from Mick Jagger, Keith Richards, Charlie Watts, and Ronnie Wood as the Rolling Stones celebrate 50.
Sunday at 9 p.m. Support for The Conversation comes from the Honolulu Museum of Art, presenting the exhibition The Arts of the Bedchamber, Japanese Shunga, opening November 23rd. Learn more at honolulumuseum.org.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. It's 8:27. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR2, Hawaii Public Radio. Support from Hawaii Public Radio's family of members keeps the programming you count on and enjoy coming your way every broadcast day. Mahalo to Jeff Dabe of Honolulu, Megan Ewan of Kapolei, and John Edmonds of Honolulu for your recent gifts. We're proud to welcome you to HPR's family of members. Join the people who are making a difference through their station membership. Follow the support link at hawaiipublicradio.org. Residents of the old Kahuku Sugar Plantation have been waiting to take ownership of their homes and the land they've lived on for years. So why are many of them being evicted or told they have to move their aging houses to a new spot and at considerable expense? CivilBeat.com editor Patty Epler joins us for today's reality check. Hi, Patty.
Good morning, Beth Ann.
Well, this is really a sad story and one that's just fraught with frustration for the folks involved. 6 years ago, the Florida developer Continental Pacific told them they could buy their lots for $75,000 and keep the houses. And not so, Joe. Didn't happen.
Yes, that's true. That's not happening. What seems to have happened is that the developer wanted to build 18 sort of luxury beachfront homes in that area. And in exchange, they were willing to let these folks who are descendants of the old plantation workers to live there at a fairly reasonable price. Then the city required an environmental impact statement, which, as we know, can be a very expensive proposition. So Continental said, nope, we're not going to do that. We're going to do another plan. The other plan, though, now has resulted in the developer telling the residents they have to pay double. That would be $150,000 for each of these lots. And they're also forcing some homes to move because now they say they're in a floodplain, even though 6 years ago, you know, they didn't tell them that.
Were they in that floodplain then?
They're like right on the water, so they're yards from the beach.
Right.
So what do you think?
Right. I mean, the point of it was nothing is changed. Now,
right.
Yeah, the developer says that they can't afford to do the EIS, and so that's why this is, you know, Plan B coming in. But there's also the undercurrent of what may be happening with the city. Is there any chance that the city is going to be able to buy this land, as we saw in the Rezo not too long ago?
So the city council did pass a resolution saying that the city should buy this property. It means the mayor needs to act. So Mayor Carlisle, who's on his way out, says he's not going to do anything with it. So that leaves it to Kirk Caldwell. Interestingly, the developer's attorney, a guy named Lex Smith, was Caldwell's campaign manager. So, of course, the two are saying there's nothing to do with that. You know, that has no bearing on it. But, you know, what do you think about that?
But is Kirk Caldwell talking to you about what his intentions are?
He is not. He was on a fishing trip when we tried to call him, and he had his assistant call us back and tell us that he was not going to comment at this time.
So at this point, you have a lot of people who are just sitting there in limbo, and they've been in that position, it seems, for 6 years. They're going to stay there a while longer.
That's true, and they are in court over it, so we'll see.
Well, maybe that will give them an out. Thanks so much. We'll talk to you the day after Thanksgiving, because tomorrow will be preempted. Lucky you.
Yay. I'm so excited. Thank you.
Thanks, Patty. Patty Epler is the editor of CivilBeat.com.
Tonight at 5, it's Bite Marks Cafe with Bert Lum and Ryan Ozawa. And I've got Bert on the line to talk about helping Hawaii companies get into the China market. Yeah, Bert?
That's right, Chris. There's been several, let's say, business opportunity trips that the organization called HiBeam has taken some tech companies over to places like Hong Kong, Shanghai, and Beijing to sort of introduce them, do a little bit of sort of matchmaking and, I guess, do the protocol for introducing them to some of the players that the executive director, Bieling Chua, at HiBeam knows of, and get them to kind of look at possible opportunities that might exist for some Hawaii companies.
Well, this is a country that for a long time did not want to be described as anything remotely capitalist, right? And now they still don't like the term capitalist, but I guess they like the term market-based economy.
And that's a good point, yeah. You know, it's one thing to be called a capitalist. It's another thing to, you know, make money, right?
Exactly. But they are, it's a land of opportunity from what I'm hearing these days.
It certainly is. But the challenges are, you know, the market-based opportunity might or economy might be a little bit differently run than it would perhaps in the U.S.
Oh, yeah.
So, you know, the doorways to get through in China are probably a lot more difficult. And of course, you know, you have to have partnerships. Probably, you know, the government is going to be involved in some manner.
Mm-hmm.
And I think most of the companies that try to really make it in China are pretty big. So, you know, I'm curious about how these small companies are trying to do it.
Well, it'll be interesting to find out. Thanks very much, Bert.
Thanks, Chris.
It's Bite Marks Cafe at 5 p.m.
This is The Conversation on HPR2. Coming up after the news, Faith on the Hill, Snakes in Church, and the answer to the Backyard Quiz. Now to Deutsche Welle for today's World Report.
DW Deutsche Welle. News.
This is Charlotte Chelsenpil in Bonn. Israeli airstrikes have pounded the Gaza Strip in another night of violence. Reporters on the ground say damage in Gaza City has been widespread and a number of media outlets have been hit. At least 130 Palestinians have been killed since the conflict re-erupted 1 week ago. Five Israelis have also been killed in rocket attacks from militants in Gaza. International mediators have been scrambling to broker a ceasefire and avert the threat of an Israeli ground invasion, but all attempts have so far failed. U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton met Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in Jerusalem for a night of talks on Tuesday. In a joint press conference, Clinton pushed for an emergency truce deal.
In the days ahead, the United States will work with our partners here in Israel and across the region toward an outcome that bolsters security for the people of Israel, improves conditions for the people of Gaza, and moves toward a comprehensive peace for all people of the region.
Eurozone finance ministers have put financial aid to Greece on hold after failing to agree on the terms of the latest bailout installment. After marathon overnight talks in Brussels, German Finance Minister Wolfgang Schäuble said ministers plan to resume negotiations on Monday. Greece's creditors have been split over whether Athens should be granted two more years to get its debt under control. But speaking after the meeting, the head of the International Monetary Fund, Christine Lagarde, said she was confident a deal would be reached to give Greece the help it needs.
We made some good work. We're closing the gap, but we're not quite there yet. So it's progress, but we have to do a bit more.
In India, the sole surviving gunman behind the 2008 terrorist siege in Mumbai has been executed. India's Home Minister, R.R. Patel, told reporters 24-year-old Ajmal Kasab was hanged at a jail in Mumbai in the early hours of Wednesday morning. His death comes just days before the four-year anniversary of the 2008 attack, in which 166 people were killed. Kasab was one of 10 Islamist gunmen who attacked multiple targets across the city, including luxury hotels, a hospital and a train station. The remaining 9 attackers were killed by security forces at the scene. There's some promising news in the global battle against the spread of HIV. According to a UN report, the number of people newly infected with the virus fell by 22% between 2001 and 2011. The report, which was conducted by the Joint United Nations Programme on HIV/AIDS, found the number of AIDS-related deaths had also dropped over the last 10 years. For more news and information, why not visit our website at dw.de? This is Charlotte Chelsenpil for Deutsche Welle News.
So what are you? Little kids often ask each other that question about ethnicity and religion to see how much others are like themselves. Now the Pew Research Center has done the same thing. It polled the newly elected 113th Congress to see who is what. And for the first time, a Buddhist will serve in the Senate. Also for the first time, a Hindu will serve in either chamber. Another first, one member of Congress who describes her religion as none will also be part of the 113th Congress. So, do these new additions mirror the American population? Hawaii Pacific University social scientist Hal Warren joins us now. Dr. Warren, thank you for being here.
Well, thank you. I'm glad to be here.
You know, looking at all this and seeing the entire breakdown of the who is what, it goes back to that idea of trying to see how well this mirrors who the American public really is and how much like us those in Congress really are. But should we be looking at this? Is this sort of a story that we need to be looking at more closely, or one that really doesn't have a whole lot of import for us?
Well, I think it fits in with the broader trends of American society. It may be a little too much to parse out, you know, the fine differences between the 112th Congress and the 113th Congress. But if we look at over the last 40 or 50 years, we do see significant shifts, and certainly the makeup of Congress reflects that. So I really put the emphasis on, you know, looking at the bigger picture. You know, sometimes we can get kind of too bogged down in the little details, but the big picture is definitely worth looking at, and it does represent significant change. When you look at the ethnic makeup of the United States over the last 50, 60 years, we are a new country in many ways.
I mean, this is far more about that kind of change than per se how many Episcopalians versus how many Jews versus how many Catholics are in the next Congress.
To some extent. I mean, we do see some broader trends. I mean, again, if we look over the last 50 years or so, the number of Protestants has gone down a fair amount, you know, from maybe the mid-70s to, I think, about 57% in Congress. You know, the number of Catholics has gone up somewhat. But that reflects broader trends in the sense that it reflects the growing Latino population in the United States. It reflects population shifts into the South, and with its strong sort of, it has a much stronger presence and maybe fewer people or population stagnation than maybe in the Midwest, you know, which tends to be a some areas have a Protestant stronghold. So you have to look at those broader trends. And to me, that's probably more relevant. It's certainly of interest, you know, when you have, you know, a Hindu or a Buddhist or somebody like that.
Both of which obviously are coming from Hawaii. Right. So for us, that's big news.
Yeah. And for us, I don't think it was any big deal. It wasn't until really late in the campaign that I even knew that Tulsi Gabbard was a Hindu or professed, you know, Hindu belief. So to me, I don't think locally that really was an issue. Maybe it is in some other parts of the country, but certainly
Congress and having the very first Buddhist or the very first in the Senate, obviously Mazie Hirono was in Congress before, but in the Senate, and having Tulsi Gabbard as a Hindu going to Congress and the first time that a Hindu has gone to Congress, period, that becomes big news, at least for people who are keeping those kinds of stats. But in
terms of
the human part of it, the human element, as we look into Congress and see how this is reflective of who we are and how we've changed and the kind of diversity that you've just been talking about, those are where more of the attention is going.
Well, mainly because people are more accepting of people of different ethnicities and religions. And so those just are not as big of an issue as might have been in the past. And so it really was not a part of the campaign. You know, it wasn't really an issue for people here, and even in other parts of the country.
We weren't seeing campaigns based on faith.
Yeah, I mean, I think people are pretty, you know, they're focusing on really what you believe in and the issues and how you approach that, and that may be shaped by faith, but just because you are an adherent to a particular church, that in itself I don't think is a very large issue for most people.
Yet some of the issues may be very driven by how faith can be divisive.
It can be. I mean, if you present yourself that way, then it could be divisive. And so I think, you know, one example would be with Mitt Romney with his Mormon faith. And here in Hawaii, we've had Mormon politicians, and it hasn't been an issue here, but I think they tend to sort of shy away from, you know, really emphasizing that element of them. You know, they certainly are not denying it, but they don't sort of put it in people's faces. They sort of downplay it somewhat.
Faith is going through, I mean, just generally in the American population, obviously, as you know, going through such a change where we're looking at younger generations, millennials and onward, who are saying they don't have a faith. And for the first time now, we have somebody in Congress who put down none.
Well, that's probably true. And when you look at the statistics that the Pew Trust put out, you have this one person who declared no faith, but about 20% of the American population says the same thing about themselves. So there's a considerable difference there. And I think there is an emphasis that you have to be of some faith, that you have to at least address it in some way. You know, you certainly don't want to be divisive. You don't want to be too strident about it. But maybe this could reflect, you know, the beginning of a new trend where more and more people who say they have no religious affiliation, you know, may be going to Congress. You know, we'll have to wait and see. So is this the beginning of a new trend? I guess time will tell.
Well, we've been seeing trends where people will say things that they are spiritually oriented but not necessarily attached to a specific religion.
Well, in some ways, that's, I think, what Tulsi has said, that she's more spiritual rather than sort of a diehard Hindu. So
the bottom line with looking at this kind of a report, how do you assess it?
I assess it as it just simply reflects broader trends of society over the last 50 or 60 years. I probably don't get too much into the, well, this faith is up a half a percentage point and this faith is down a half a percentage point, because a lot of that just really depends
on
the individuals. And that's more important than the fact that you're a Presbyterian versus an Episcopalian. That to me doesn't really, you know, interest me that much. So I think it's very interesting in the sense that it reflects changes in society over a much longer period of time, and
Dr. Warren, we're going to have to leave it there. Thanks so much for joining us. Hal Warren, Ph.D., is the Assistant Department Chair of Social Sciences at Hawaii Pacific University. The Pew Report is on Facebook at Hawaii Conversation.
Aloha, I'm Ann Brandman from UH Manoa Outreach College. You're listening to The Conversation on HPR 2. Find out more about the show at hawaiipublicradio.org/theconversation.
So it's the day before Thanksgiving, and even if you'll be at work today, mentally you may already be preparing your feast, or if you're a really organized cook, perhaps you've been at it for days. Still, tomorrow is all about the bird. Yours probably came from your favorite grocery store, where it was shipped from the mainland. There are, though, turkeys in Hawaii. Mostly Rio Grandes are on the Big Island now. Once turkeys were on all islands, including Niihau, Molokai, and Lanai. Today we asked you when and how they came to be here. Wild turkeys and possibly rock pigeons were the first game birds brought to Hawaii Island from China and introduced post-contact. Populations have crashed and come back. Different species have been reintroduced and mingled. But turkeys have been in Hawaii since 1788. So maybe Ben Franklin was right about that tenacious turkey after all. That's today's quiz. If you've got one, send it in to talkback at hawaiipublicradio.org.
Tyler Nichols is a young theater director with a determination to take his audiences closer to a world they've probably never seen, the world of rural southern churches, where congregation members speak in tongues, heal the sick through the power of touch, and handle snakes. It's a deep expression of faith, frightening and awe-inspiring at the same time, and it's a powerful subject for theater. Tyler is directing The Handler as his Master of Fine Arts thesis, and we spoke with him about the challenges of bringing his play to the stage.
I think the major challenge of it was just trying to be truthful to the material, because it does involve a snake handling church, so which is I think completely foreign here, because you know snakes are illegal, you can't even have them as pets, and so when we actually do a service on stage, and so when we were working with the cast to try and do that, there was a lot of giggles and a lot of uncomfortable nature of having them pass around these fake snakes and speaking in tongues and such, and really having to focus on treating it with the reverence and the seriousness that it takes on. Because if you kind of play it like wink, wink, oh, we know this is silly, then the audience isn't going to buy into it either.
You really need to take it as seriously in the presentation as the people who are doing it.
Oh, absolutely, because for them it's deadly serious. Yeah. You know, I mean, you're handling rattlesnakes and copperheads, and you know, if you get bit, you might pull through, but if you take one in the neck or in the face, then you know that's your G-O-N-E.
And this is something that happens in rural southern churches, that people, it's an expression of your faith.
Oh, absolutely. There's a verse in Mark, and it goes on about how, you know, those that believe can cast out devils, and they will speak in tongues, and they can drink poison, and they can handle serpents and not be harmed. And so they take this very literally as a way of showing affinity with God. And if you believe enough, and if you're one with the Spirit, then you will be safe. And if you're not, then that's showing you something about your life, and maybe you need to go and be a little more introspective on your sins.
How do you convey the intensity of that experience through theater? How do you bring that out of your actors?
Well, we a lot of hard work, I guess.
I don't doubt it. Yeah.
We live in the technological age, which is, you know, just absolutely fantastic. So there's a lot of free documentaries and stuff on like YouTube and on the internet. And so we just spent a lot of time just researching and really trying to, before we even got to doing the church scenes, just doing a lot of very intense character work and trying to really find out who these people are.
Mm-hmm.
So that when it actually got to the more intense scenes, the actors were prepared because they knew what it meant for the characters that they were attempting to portray.
So you've watched documentary video of snake handling and speaking in tongues and people, you know, being commanded to rise from a wheelchair, that kind of thing.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir.
And then this happens.
Yes, it does. I'm not going to say it's super common because it's not like every church in the South does it, and I don't want that to be the impression by any stretch of the imagination.
Sure.
But it does happen. My father, actually, and I did not know this until I was talking to him about doing the play, he told me that when he was a little boy, he actually went to a church where they did these things.
Mm-hmm.
And I was like, well, what was that like, Dad? And he's like, oh, it was terrifying. You know, just to see a woman stand up and just start speaking in tongues and fall over a grown woman and to see a, you know, 4.5 foot, 5 foot rattlesnake get passed around is horrifying.
Well, if you've seen anything like this in a religious ceremony, the intensity of the experience for the people taking part is almost unbearable to watch, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. And you can just look at still photographs, and they just look like they are in an immense amount of pain.
Yeah.
And this, it's not religious ecstasy. It's just, it's almost like they're just grieving.
Mm-hmm.
It's very, very powerful.
I once saw a service where the minister walked down a line of people and just touched each one on the head, and as soon as he touched them, they just went out like a sack of potatoes,
mm-hmm.
you know, just went, immediately lost consciousness, had somebody behind them to catch them,
yeah.
and then awoke, you know, refreshed and rejuvenated. I mean, it has an effect, you know, no matter what its veracity, right?
It does, and even though we're only just kind of, we're actors and we're portraying it on stage, whenever we're done with the scene, the actors all have to kind of take a moment and, you know, wipe their brow and breathe, because they get so into it. And the guy, Matthew Kelty, who's playing Brother Bob, the preacher, he says, you know, the more you do it, the better it feels, and so you just get further and further into it every time you go.
Well, you would also see the lure, the sense of power.
Oh, absolutely.
That the preacher would get.
Oh, yes, because there's just something about a group of people just believing in something and wanting something so strongly that it draws you, it
mm-hmm.
draws you into it, and I can really see how people could get into it.
I would think that for the actors, it would be very hard to portray any other way except by completely kind of surrendering to the experience.
That is absolutely the case, and you can see it's so evident when somebody's not willing to take that step. Unfortunately, I feel like we've really separated ourselves from that, and
mm-hmm.
the actors are just absolutely willing to just forego any sort of pride or ego and any belief that they might look silly, and just absolutely give themselves to it. And it's really been a wonderful experience for me as a director to have people willing to do that.
Well, that's what you had to set the tone for that as a director,
yes,
didn't
sir,
you?
Absolutely.
How do you express that to them? Just more or less the way you just did?
Yes, yeah, absolutely. You just have to just kind of try and break them down, because there's always going to be a lot of resistance whenever somebody feels like what they're doing is silly or ridiculous, and just kind of having to get them to, they're like, hey, trust me, like, it's going to look good, it's going to be believable, and you will be powerful on stage.
And that would be the challenge for a director, no matter what
right.
the plot, you know,
right,
whether
right,
it's a
right.
comedy, whether it's Chekhov or
musicals.
It's going to be something, no, people don't ordinarily burst into song, but in this musical you're going to have to.
Right, and I taught high school for a year before I came to UH.
Uh-huh.
And that was something that I always had to teach my students, was that you can't play this whole wink, wink, audience, I know that this is silly, I'm with it, I'm with you, because then you look terrible.
Yeah. So you have to, the way to not look terrible is one of immersion in the role.
Absolutely. Because if you're in the moment, nobody's going to go, oh, that's so silly that he was in the moment. They're just going to be with you.
Tyler Nichols is a theater director and MFA candidate at UH Manoa's Department of Theater and Dance. He's the director of The Handler, which runs November 28th through December 2nd at the Earl Ernst Lab Theater. Details are on our Hawaii Conversation Facebook page.
Support for The Conversation comes from the Island Insurance Foundation, committed to making a difference in our local communities by keeping our money working in Hawaii.
Hi, it's Lynn Rossetto Casper, host of The Splendid Table. Be sure to join me for our annual Turkey Bacchanal, Turkey Confidential, live on Thanksgiving morning. We'll be here to take your calls with some of our favorite friends, Marcus Samuelson, Rick Bayless, and Ina Garten. It's culinary triage on the day you need it most. That's Turkey Confidential live Thanksgiving morning from 8 p.m.
Thursday morning from 6 to 8. Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Servco Lexus, introducing the 2013 ES and ES Hybrid, dedicated to providing power, comfort, safety, and efficiency. The new Lexus ES and ES Hybrid are now available at Servco Lexus dealers.
Interesting, Beth Ann, the disconnect between the number of people in Congress who identify themselves as religious and the number of people in society as large, at large.
Well, I think that's the whole point of it. It may be interesting to look at what the religious makeup is of Congress. But more interesting, I think, is the fact that we've seen this trend of people saying that they are not affiliated. And as Dr. Warren was saying, 20% of us say that we are not affiliated with any religion. There's one person in Congress who this year, I think her name is Sinema, who says she...
Only one, right,
who will be coming in next time, who says that she has no religion.
Which takes some guts, because in American politics to this day, you dare not run for office without identifying yourself as a member of some sort of religion and, you know, getting your picture taken ideally in the classic paradigm is getting a picture with your beautiful family going to church every Sunday. That's the way it was for a long time in this country. And, you know, despite our separation of church and state, there was that need in the electorate to identify the people it voted for as religious.
Well, once upon a time when we had the very first Catholic, too, and the very first.
Yeah.
And now the first Hindu, the first Buddhist going to the Senate. I mean, lucky for Hawaii that we can say, yes, they came from here. But, you know, we'll wait and see if any of this really does play out in terms of what people do and how it reflects how our trends are changing.
Exactly.
That's it for today. Tomorrow, special holiday programming, a lot of food on Friday. We'll be back to talk about what makes a product local.
And Kumukuhua Theater wants you to write a play.
You can tweet us. You can get us on Facebook. All of that you can find right on our website.
Our podcast, the archive, and the link to Facebook are all on that website, hawaiipublicradio.org/theconversation. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Kozlovich. We'll meet you back here on Friday for more of The Conversation. Happy Thanksgiving. Mm-hmm.